supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We have always adored celebrities. Just think about the glamorous movie stars of the 50s or the Beatles in the 60s. But now there seems to be a new trend, spawned maybe by reality TV and the expanded news coverage. Fame for the sake of fame. Think about it. What was it that made Anna Nicole Smith famous, really? Even though she was a playmate, she only achieved real fame when she married the 89-year-old billionaire J. Howard Marshall. And what has Paris Hilton ever done to deserve our attention? When did private sex videos become a hallmark of accomplishment? And why are millions of people these days dreaming of becoming famous? Jake Halpern explores our obsession with celebrity in his new book, Fame Junkies. He's a freelance producer for NPR's All Things Considered. And we're also joined by Peter Weibrow. He's a psychiatrist and director of the Institute for Neuroscience and Behavior at UCLA. His most recent book is called American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. Jake and Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Our telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about fame, the pursuit of it. Is that your dream? Was it your dream? Maybe you are famous. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Jake, let's start with you. You point out in your book that when the Gallup poll about which man was most admired, when that poll began in 63, the people on the list were Lyndon Johnson, Churchill, Martin Luther King. There was not one celebrity or sports star. And in 2005, the list included Mel Gibson, Donald Trump, Michael Jordan, and Rush Limbaugh. 2005 must not have been a real good year. So what happened in those 40 years?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things that have changed, but one of the things that I look at is the extent to which entertainment news and entertainment figures have come to occupy a more prominent space in the mainstream news than they ever had in the past. So Donald Trump is a good example. He had this tiff with Rosie O'Donnell about a month ago, and when that happened, it was the lead story on the art section of the New York Times. I think that 10 years ago, the Times would have ignored it, but now you're just as likely to see stories about celebrities being featured prominently on CNN and in the New York Times and elsewhere as you are in Entertainment Tonight. And one quick example of this, which is kind of scary, in the year of the Martha Stewart scandal, the three major nightly news networks, which at the time were Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, and Tom Brokaw, devoted 130 minutes to Martha Stewart and just 25 minutes to the genocide in Darfur. So I think that there's a sense that these people, that the news covers them in a way that they, in the past, would have covered someone like Churchill or Lyndon Johnson or the traditional historical figures.
Well, let's go back to your Times observation about the Trump-Rosie O'Donnell conflict. You said they would not have done it 10 years ago. Why are they doing it now?
I think that there's a sense that I think the Times, in some ways, is the last people to jump onto this. And I think their sense is if we don't cover this, everyone else is talking about this, and we'll be obsolete. I think that, in particular, in some ways, the stronger example is the CNN and the nightly news. I think their motivation is kind of a hemorrhaging of viewers with cable news and with the internet. There are so many other places that people can go to get their news that there's kind of an instinct to gravitate towards the lowest common denominator. If we put celebrities at the top of the story, at the top of the hour, we might hold our own against Fox and the other places that are giving them increasing coverage.
Peter, from a social psychological point of view, there have been many changes in our culture over the last decades, and specifically in my mind, the way we live with one another. Surveys asking people about how many intimate friends they have, those numbers are shrinking over the last several decades. We do seem more isolated. I wonder, do you think that affects our relationship with celebrities, relationship in quotes?
I think so, Dan. I think you put your finger on it. You know, the interest in social gossip has been there forever in human society. Most of us spend, if you analyze what do people talk about with each other, most of the time they're talking about other people and their relationships to other people. 60-70% of conversation is about that. So in small, intimate societies, that was... We used to talk about the local scandals and the local butcher and whether his meat was good and so on and so forth. But that has all changed dramatically now with the way in which we live our lives. And electronic systems enable us to gobble information that's well beyond our immediate community. In fact, our immediate community is now so diminished that we hardly live in communities. So the gossip has changed in its focus. But gossip is still very much something that feeds us and, of course, is tied to the social hierarchy in which we live. And so celebrity is just another way of talking about those who are in the social hierarchy, driven now, as Jake was saying, by the commercial investment. It's a huge, huge business that drives celebrity interest, and that has grown extraordinarily in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and so many other things have shrunken. You say that 60% of our conversation is gossip, and yet all of our mothers and most of our religions said you shouldn't gossip. It's not a good thing.
Well, I think what people say when they say you shouldn't gossip is they're talking about the sort of quasi-naughty moral stuff that you shouldn't be saying about your neighbor. But in fact, if you listen carefully when you go into a public place. Of course, the problem is now that everybody's gossiping on their cell phone, so you can't hear really what they are saying because the conversation on the other side isn't there. But think about it when you go into a social situation where you are having a conversation, and just listen, and you'll know that most people are talking about other people. They're talking about what other people do, and of course, the tabloids, which have become so much a commercial advantage for many of the print media and the television and so on. The reality shows are an example of that. These are just an extension of that same concept. So, what we used to call gossip had a pejorative sense, but gossip in general is not necessarily pejorative. In fact, it is something where we learn our social mores. The gossip of the society was that if you learn about your fellow man, and these sometimes are cautionary tales, sometimes they're uplifting, heroic tales, one learns one's own place in that society and what one can and cannot do within the social mores.
Which is probably why we like to read biographies. Jake,
absolutely.
Jake, when you got started with this book, your research showed that our interest in celebrities is almost primordial and can be traced back to the Stone Age. Even monkeys seem to be interested in the dominant monkey.
Yeah, there's some really interesting studies that have been done down at Duke University that showed in a troop of rhesus monkeys, there's always a dominant monkey that often exhibits some kind of eerily celebrity-like behavior, kind of demanding tribute from the other monkeys and throwing tantrums if they don't get it. And in this particular troop of monkeys, the subordinate monkeys were given a choice. They could either stare at pictures of the dominant monkeys or press a button and get food. And they found that more often than not, the monkeys opted to stare at the pictures of the dominant monkeys in their group.
That's amazing.
And the thinking is pretty straightforward, I'd say intuitive, that if you keep a close eye on the person that is in a powerful position within your group and you gather social information about that, I guess in this case monkey, where they sleep, what they eat, who their mates are, all that kind of thing, would help you survive and help you pass along your genes. And so over time, evolution would have favored those primates that were keyed into this information, and that arguably our own brains are hardwired in a similar sort of way, only now we're getting distracted because our peer group is being kind of hijacked by these celebrities, and we're kind of getting, we're watching Tom Cruise jumping up and down on a couch instead of, and other kind of celebrities and their kind of strutting instead of the people that are directly in our peer group that we could ostensibly learn something from or benefit from.
Which leads me to a follow-up question. Now that you mentioned Tom Cruise, have you done any research or discovered any research on why we love to hate fallen celebrities? I mean, Mel Gibson and Michael Richards and Tom Cruise. I mean, you know, we really enjoyed hating them.
I think that with celebrities, it's always a fine line, because on the one hand, we kind of enjoy following their lives in a vicarious way. We enjoy seeing all of the kind of glamour and glitz of their life, but it always rides a fine line of spilling into resentment. And I think that those celebrities that kind of seem to abuse their power, it's not totally unlike politics in that regard. Those who sort of take us for granted and kind of flaunt it a bit too much, we quickly kind of tips the scales into the sense of their entitlement upsets us and makes us feel resentful. So I think with any given celebrity, you're always kind of, you know, in some ways riding this line between admiring them and hating them. And it's kind of often their behavior in a given moment that will kind of, you know, make us go one way or the other.
Peter,
I think that's also the cautionary tale, what Jake's talking about there, actually, Dan. I think, you know, when somebody does get caught for drunk driving, everybody says, "I told you so." You know, that's not a good thing. You can bolster yourself up with all this good Christian stuff, but then you get caught drunk driving. Let me just tell you that this is not good for society. So I think that little story then becomes something that shapes people's own visions of what they might do themselves. At least it used to. I mean, that's the way in which, for example, markets, as I describe in American Mania, are kept in control. That's why when you have a small local community, greed and excess tends to be kept down by exactly the construct that you were just discussing with Jake.
What's Peter, I'll turn to you. I'd like to hear your take on reality TV and this development of our pursuit of fame. It does mean the potential for fame is much more accessible.
Well, I think that's extremely fascinating. A year or two ago, actually, I was in England talking to one of the producers of one of the big shows there, the reality TV shows, and we got into quite a heated discussion about what is the motivation behind that. Because, in fact, if you think about what we've been discussing in the last few minutes, the reality TV show takes the local community, it's a false community, of course, especially when you have something like a group of people living in a house for 8 weeks or whatever it is. That is one of the shows in England that became famous recently. I forget the name of it, but Jake may remember it. But when you put people into that false situation, you eventually begin to see all the social interactions that go on in small communities, which fascinate people, coming back to the whole gossip thing. And so at that point, you have something which people are drawn to, especially when they don't have a community of their own. I live in an apartment house, for example, here in Los Angeles. It's a large apartment house, and I know a few people on the floor in which I live, but not very many, when you consider that we are obviously a community in terms of our geographic locus. It's surprising that I don't know more people, but that's because we all go up and down in the elevator. You can't go from one floor to another without having a special key, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that these little communities on reality TV they fill a gap that we have created in our electronically driven fast world, and then it becomes obvious to sensible businessmen that this is a huge money spinner.
So they address our longing for for community.
I mean, the preview of the reality show was probably things like Friends, in the sense that that was a contrived reality show. He was even called Friends. I mean, we then get to the point where you taking ordinary people and putting them in a house is a lot less costly than paying actors $1 million a session.
Jake, Jake, I wonder about the other side of it. One of the early reality TV shows was probably Jerry Springer. Why would someone do that?
Well, I think that, you know, there's always a bit of a Faustian bargain with people who want fame. And I think that for, you know, in the TV era, it's been kind of the cost has been personal humiliation. And if you're willing to endure the personal humiliation, you get the few minutes of glory. I mean, I think a really recent example of that is American Idol. I mean, you see these teenagers that are getting on the show that aren't particularly talented singers and are often ridiculed by the judges, and they do it. But I think it's important to think about what happens after that. So the kid goes back to their high school. Maybe there were kind of a pariah in the school, like sitting by themselves at the cafeteria. And you have to imagine that all of a sudden, perhaps even the kids at the popular table are going to look over at this kid and say, hey, that was pretty crazy what you did last night. And that kid's going to be acknowledged and going to get recognition. I mean, even the person they nicknamed, I think, Bush Baby, because the Simon Cowell called him, he said he looked like he came from the bush, he was on Jimmy Kimmel the next day. So society kind of has a way of rewarding even people that achieve notoriety. And I think this is particularly true among the teenage demographic, which is so key to American Idol, and which, as I talk about in my book, is particularly susceptible to wanting fame.
So the great myth out there is, if you're famous, then you'll be happy. But, you know, a study by Charles Figley at Florida State shows that celebrities are much higher risk for stress, depression, anxiety.
I think that's true. I mean, I like to think of it as when we go to the checkout at the supermarket, there's always two windows we can get into this world. There's the Us Weekly kind of People magazine, where it's just kind of everything is kind of perfectly glossy, and then there's the National Enquirer, where you see the drug addiction and the bulimia and the divorce. And I think people kind of select what they want to see, and if they subscribe to the belief that fame is going to improve their lives, they kind of push out the National Enquirer and just hone in on the Malibu pool party in Us Weekly and think, that's going to be the fix-it for my life. And an awful lot of young people, it seems, in particular, tend to do that.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. We'll hear an interview that Mike and Scott did about somebody who desperately wants to be famous, and then we'll take some calls. We're talking about fame junkies, what we see in our celebrities, why so many of us desperately want celebrity status, what it means. My guest is author Jake Halpern. He's a freelance producer for All Things Considered. His current book is called Fame Junkies, The Hidden Truth Behind America's Favorite Addiction. My other guest is Dr. Peter Weibrow, psychiatrist, director of the Institute for Neuroscience and Behavior at UCLA, and his most recent book is called American Mania, Where More Is Not Enough. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you dream of being a celebrity, or if you are a celebrity, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, how do you translate an intimate, conversational, and great radio show to the TV screen? We talk with Ira Glass about the challenges of creating a Showtime version of This American Life. It premieres next month. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family, where we're talking about America's obsession with fame, where it comes from, what fuels it. Every week, we watch people pursue some measure of fame on various reality TV shows. And if you've ever walked by a place where movie editions are being held, you'll see lines going around the block. So what drives people who wants to be famous? Well, our producer, Mike and Scott, spoke with one of them. His name is Craig Lagones. He's an actor and most recently starred in his own one-man show called My Life in 19 Inches.
Do you want to be famous?
I want to be famous more than anything.
Why?
Because I think I have something to say, and I think I have enough talent that people would appreciate what I do.
How do you think fame would change you?
I'm afraid that because I'm very egotistical, very arrogant. I see myself in nothing but a positive light. So I think fame would just enhance that. So I think I'd be even more of a bigger pain in the butt.
What have you done to attain fame?
I've done my own one-man show. I've written some sketches that I've gotten on the air on a public TV station. I've done some short films with some friend of mine that have been on independent festivals. We won some awards for that. I audition at least once a month for any part that I feel I can get. But mostly I'm just writing my own stuff, trying to create my own door into fame, since not a lot of doors are going to open up for me automatically, so I have to build my own door.
What is stronger, your desire to act and to get your stuff out there, or your desire to be out there and for people to know you?
I think that's what I got, Mike, and more than anything else, I got the desire. It's like I have more of that, the desire to be famous, and I've put more energy and thought into the lights, the camera, than the actual going out and making it happen. The unglamorous part, sitting in my bedroom writing my own show, it's like I want to forego all that and just get right to the end and just get right to the stage, the lights, the applause.
How do you like your life now? Do you feel like you're happy with your life where you are? Or are you always dreaming of what your life could be?
I'm usually dreaming about what my life could be if, when I watch the Oscars, I think, man, that would be so much fun to walk down the red carpet.
But are you ever worried that because you have a dream and a burning desire and you're envisioning your life different from what it is, are you ever worried that maybe you're not enjoying your life now to the fullest potential?
I'm never worried about that because I've always been incredibly happy. I've been surrounded by great friends, a great family, great girlfriend / wife. So I've always been happy in that respect. I like what I have now, but at the same time, I know with what I've been given talent-wise, I know I can reach a broader audience. I know with what I can do, I can get a bigger apartment or a bigger house or a bigger car and, unprecedented fame. So I like to take what I'm happy with now and just magnify that.
So what if it doesn't happen?
Oh, you sound like my mom, every friend I've ever had, I'll be happy. If it never happens, I'm happy with the work I have done, with the things that I have achieved, with the amount of people that I've touched and the amount of joy that I've brought to my friends, family, and total strangers. I'll be very happy with that.
Fame has a lot of financial rewards, and obviously you get to show your work to a much bigger audience, but there's also the aspect of being adored.
Yeah.
Do you like that?
I guess it's about the being noticed thing. I like the idea of someone patting me on the shoulder and said, I really like your stuff. And it's great from friends and family, but I want total strangers. I want millions and millions of people around the country saying how cool I am and how great I am. I want William in Pawtucket, Iowa to say, I like Craig. That holds more weight for me than the financial stuff. The idea of acting for a living, I'd do it for free because it's fun. But the positive, obviously, the lore of girls screaming for you, crying at the sight of you and stuff, holds a lot of, carries a lot of weight.
Not a lot of people would admit that.
I'm one of those people, If I could walk out of my apartment and shake hands with folks and say, hey, I love your stuff, and I'd say thank you, and I just get that positive feedback, I'd be happy with that. I don't need the million-dollar paychecks.
Just the love.
Just the love.
I love your stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That means more to me than $1 million. You keep your $1 million.
Thank you for the interview.
Thank you, Mike.
That was Mike and Scott, who got to keep her $1 million And she spoke with Craig Lagones. He's an actor, writer, and future celebrity. He most recently starred in his own one-man show called My Life in 19 Inches. We're talking about celebrity, what it means, who they are to us, why we're so interested in them, and why we want to be them. My guests are Dr. Peter Weibrow, psychiatrist, director of the Institute for Neuroscience and Behavior at UCLA. His most recent book is American Mania, Where More Is Not Enough. I'm also joined by author Jake Halpern. He's, in addition to writing several books, he's a freelance producer for All Things Considered. His current book is called Fame Junkies, The Hidden Truth Behind America's Favorite Addiction. Well, gentlemen, we heard a lot of things from Craig. One of the things he talked about, he said very openly, was that he was pretty egotistical. He had a pretty high self-image. I guess that's necessary, important for those who pursue celebrity. Any comments?
I think, Dan, you're a consummate therapist, my sense is that I don't know about that particular man, but my suspicion is that many celebrities are driven, in fact, by a need for the sort of feedback that he was describing, but inside they have a rather low self-esteem. That's much of what I see here in Hollywood, anyway. And that's not exclusively so, but it's true for many people who crash and burn even when they're doing quite well. I think that we have built a society, really, where our culture is very invested in the individual and in creating the supplies that are necessary to make that individual feel better. We're told constantly if we have a bigger house, as he was describing, or a bigger car, or a bigger this, that we're going to be more famous and to feel better. So I think that we've, to some degree, the culture drives this phenomenon in a way that it's not necessarily so in all societies. America is somewhat unique in its celebrity worship. It's obviously there in other cultures, but we are completely addicted to it, as Jake was saying earlier.
Jake, Craig said it at the end. He said, I want to be adored.
Yeah.
You know what? Me too. I mean, being adored ain't a bad thing. Do celebrities get adored?
Oh, there's no question about it. It's what's interesting to me, though, is we all want to be adored, but why is it not enough to be adored by our close friends and family? Why
exactly,
is it necessary that we be adored by William in Pawtucket, Iowa? And, you know, I think that's a tough question. One of the things I think about is there has been all this talk about the self-esteem curriculums that have been in place in American schools since the 70s, in the sense that we have kind of a culture of telling our kids, you're great, you're wonderful, you're the best. And I think that I'm wondering, and I posit this question in my book, to what extent that kind of feeds this desire for kind of an ever greater level of validation. That at some point, if you're constantly affirmed by your parents and teachers and they tell you everything you do is wonderful, that the kind of high that gives you kind of wears off and you want it on an even more. And I think that there's some there are some numbers, too, that kind of that pushed this idea forward. For example, in the 1950s, they would ask teenagers this question, I am an important person, yes or no? And this is part of the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Test. And back then, only 12% of teenagers said yes to that question, whereas today that number has risen to 80%. And I think that there's also evidence showing that narcissism is up in teens. There's something called the Narcissism Personality Index that asks a number of questions like, someday someone ought to write a biography about my life, I start new fads and fashions wherever I go. And they've given this test to demographics around the world. There's a guy down at University of Georgia named Keith Campbell who's done this. And no group scores higher than the American teenager. So I think that that's the generation of young people now that we're seeing as so fame crazy. And I think that what fame represents in its purest form is that thunderous validation that Craig was speaking of.
Well, lest we go off and pathologize this too much. You know, and I'm thinking of one of your surveys that you reported on, Jake, where boys and girls were asked whether they would rather be intelligent or famous, and boys picked intelligent and famous about 50-50, and more girls said they'd rather be famous than intelligent. But I remember when I was a kid having dreams of being on the Johnny Carson show as a world-famous stand-up comedian.
How did you think you would get there, Dan? I mean, I think that's you are a fairly famous radio show host, but you didn't get there just by hoping for it at the age of 18. I mean, one of the interesting things is that there is a gap, I think, as Jake was just pointing out, between the self-sense that is now given to many young people and the work that it takes to create what is socially valid in any society. And I think, although we don't talk about it very much in our in society here, the commercial drive is one of the very important things. Individuals, we're very individualistic. Americans are very individualistic. And so we've recognized commercially now that you're not going to make a lot of money by talking about how good it is to help at your local church or help the person in the street who can't cross the street. You're going to make a lot of money by focusing upon the individual, and this ties right back to the whole idea that we have this positive reinforcement where every young person is unique, and every young person is unique, but that doesn't mean that they're socially going to be rich and famous. Mm-hmm. One of the most amazing statistics to me that I discovered when writing American Mania was that somewhere around 70% of the American population think it's just a matter of time before they become rich and famous. And this enables us to paper over extraordinary social differences in our society, some of which are extraordinarily self-destructive and also destructive to the social fabric which we need to maintain a society.
There's a relatively recent study, and I don't remember it crystal clear, but it's relatively recent, that talked about the harmful effects of lavishing praise on children. When we begin to praise who they are rather than what they've done and tell them that they're wonderful every step of the way or they're great, that it really cuts down on motivation, it cuts down on their resilience, and it cuts down on their risk-taking.
On their self-esteem, too, right. Because, if you never achieve anything except by having somebody tell you that you're great, and then you go out in the world and it turns out that everybody doesn't agree with that assessment, then that's the beginning of some rather self-destructive thoughts. One of the interesting things which I think validates what you just said is that studies now in families where the income is above $150,000 a year as opposed to the median, which is about $50,000, the children in those families, the younger children, teenagers and so on, they have a much higher incidence of poor self-esteem, depression, suicidal ideation, drug addiction than do the individuals in the lower socioeconomic families, which comes as a big surprise to a lot of people.
I want to get to the phones. Peter, you'll have to come back for another show where you and I will talk about the difference between real self-esteem and narcissism, because that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Charles, who's been patiently waiting for a while. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I was once a recording artist, hip-hop recording artist in Europe, and I left that, and right now I'm actually a prison chaplain in New Jersey. And I went from this whole thing of going for fame and fortune to just really trying to make a difference underground and not really caring about whether people in Dakota knew about it or not, based on finding my own purpose and connecting to what I can give, whether it be so small or to society, just giving something unique. And that's one of the things I'm wondering about, what we can do with kids. I mean, my work with prisoners is that they need to find some purpose. And I find that a lot of young people just need to have real focus on what they can do that is unique on the earth, and whether it benefits 10 people or 10,000 people, that they be satisfied with that. And I'm just wondering if there is some way to really try and bring that understanding to schools and not just giving credits for better grades or getting certain awards, and therefore having more opportunity if you have better grades, more money, but rather gaining self-esteem from, look, I have something unique to give to the world. Let me just give that, be happy with that, and move
well,
on.
I wonder if the ultimate goal is self-esteem or if it's the illusion of security. I'd like to come back to your story. You bridged a gap here between pursuing your own fame and celebrity to reaching out to others and finding a purpose. What fill in those steps in between those? What changed your mind, your thinking?
Well, I think the watershed moment was I was in the middle of having a recording about to be released in France, and I was engaged a model going out to clubs. I thought I had made it, and I called a friend of mine back here in the States and was just complaining. I was complaining about everything. I was complaining about how I wasn't feeling right, how I wasn't feeling like it was enough. And my friend stopped me and said, wait a minute, this is it. You know, this is the life. This is what people are fighting to have. And I realized that that wasn't enough for me. And if that's not enough, I mean, it really took courage for me to say, wow, what I thought was enough is not enough. Let me rethink and reshift what does matter to me.
Can you tell us where you find the courage? Jake talks about this as being an addiction, and he lays out a powerful argument to suggest it is actually an addiction. Where did you find the courage to walk away?
Oh, man, it came from, first of all, feeling, after fulfilling my addiction, still feeling alone. Mm. And it came to a point of, I had to say to myself, this addiction is not fulfilling this need for community. It's not fulfilling my need for being happy about who I am and where I am. So if this isn't working, what would? And even though what I thought would work is all I know or all I knew at the time, I got to let it go. I got to let it go and go toward the mysterious, go toward what I don't know, try something else, because what I do now, what I know now, just isn't working.
Well, you know, certainly you benefited, and a lot of others have benefited. I'm gonna ask both of my guests to comment on what they've heard, and I want to thank you. Thank you for calling, and thank you for what you do.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Jake, any reaction to what you've heard from Charles?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of admiration for him from kind of walking away from that, and I think it's more difficult than people realize. You know, in the addiction literature, they often talk about addiction as being for people who have the addiction, describing it as a void, a kind of chasm into which you pour the energy of the addiction, whether it's alcohol or gambling, or, as I argue in my book, the desire for fame, in the hope that it will make you feel whole or complete or loved or what have you. But it doesn't. It just leaves you feeling emptier. So even when the guy from Pawtucket, Iowa says, hey, I saw you and I loved your show, you get this momentary high, but afterwards you feel just as empty inside, just as perhaps unfulfilled or unloved as you did. And the temptation is, well, I just need more of that. And I think that ultimately that's not going to set you up in a good place. And I think that your caller was kind of fortunate to realize that and to kind of direct himself in a more meaningful way, because ultimately, like any addiction, I think there's also a cost, which is, you know, he made reference to this call that he had with a friend where, fortunately, he listened to what the friend said and got something out of it, but I think all too often you'd have a situation where the person would just continue complaining to the friend, and eventually the friendship would erode, and that's another sign of addiction, I think, is that when the other things in your personal life and friends start to kind of wither because you're so consumed by what it is that you need to fulfill that need. So what he's saying definitely hits home with the research I did in my book.
Hmm. We've got to take a short break. I want to come back and raise the question, I guess, to you, Peter, about what is the goal here? Is the goal fame and fortune, or is the goal happiness and security? I'd like to explore that. We're talking about fame and celebrity, why so many want to pursue it, why we're so interested in it. My guests are Peter Weibrow, psychiatrist, director of the Institute for Neuroscience and Behavior at UCLA. His most recent book is American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. I'm also joined by Jake Halpern, a freelance producer with All Things Considered. His current book is called Fame Junkies, The Hidden Truth Behind America's Favorite Addiction. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Reese Witherspoon won an Academy Award for playing June Carter.
I must have been crazy. You can't walk no line.
Jamie Foxx won playing Ray Charles.
Let me hear you say amen.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman as Truman Capote.
Yeah, I've decided on a title for my book, In Cold Blood.
Are real-life characters and actors' best shot at an Oscar?
A post-Oscar look at the biopic.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about celebrity, why we are so interested in them, and why so many of us want to be one. My guests are Jake Halpern, freelance producer with All Things Considered. He's written Fame Junkies, The Hidden Truth Behind America's Favorite Addiction. Peter Weibrow is a psychiatrist, director of the Institute for Neuroscience at UCLA, and his most recent book is American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. Before we go back to the calls, Peter, let me just pose that question to you. What is the goal, ultimately, when we're pursuing fame?
Well, I think your caller earlier put it very well. I mean, he has seen both sides of that particular question, and there's no doubt that when people are caught up in the excitement of fame and the it's just like any other addiction, as I think Jake has written about, which is that you can't put it down. It becomes, if you look at the brain science under it, and we don't have time really to do that in detail, there's no doubt that it provides the rush, and you can see that biologically and even in imaging, that it creates a short circuit, essentially, of the usual things that make for happiness and social behavior. We are social animals. I mean, we have a very big brain, a very big frontal brain, which is the one that enables us to have these very complex social behaviors. But in fact, that's what brings us a sense of contentment. So if you move from the hip-hop world into being a chaplain in a prison, it counterintuitive to American way of life, the person now is happier. And in fact, I think that what he's discovered is that he now has a social place within a hierarchy which is stable, and he's able to give of himself and to receive, and that is what changes the way he feels about himself, and that it's that interaction with other people, just because we are social animals. It's a pseudo form of it that you see in celebrity chasing, that because that is then divorced from reality, and it's a mirage, basically, which substitutes for what we really want, which is, I think, why he described feeling hollow.
Huh. Let's go to the phones. We've got Brendan on the line. Brendan, hi.
Yeah, I guess I want to first of all thank you, Dan, for your program. It really helps, and I think the issue you brought up today is very serious. The question I have for the panelists are, what is going to be the evolution of this addiction to fame? You know, we see it at a very low point now in our society, and, you know, we start to question the motives behind it. What's it going to be like 30 or 40 years from now? Where they truly will do anything, you know, and this pageantry that continues. I mean, what is going to be the next step?
Well, I think that's a great question. Will we continue to devolve, or will we find some semblance of community?
Right. Is there going to be a backlash? Is there going to be suddenly people are going to start embracing wholesome programming, or put the right people up as heroes again and role models? I mean, where is this going to evolve?
Well, let's see.
Well, if I take a quick stab at that, I think the pendulum was going to swing back. I mean, I think that and I'll tell you why, because of the individualistically driven society cannot sustain itself, and that's what we've built. And in the long run, you will see a swing back to social concern because the others will implode. Now, there are always going to be some people, especially if you foster it in the commercial enterprise, that will go the route of what we're seeing here, which is the extraordinary narcissism. But in fact, one can argue, and there are good statistics on this, that a healthful society is not the one where you have this extraordinary disparity of income between the celebrity group and those who feed and foster them, and others who are extraordinarily poor. America's spread of income is extremely large, greater than any other country in the world, and I think slowly we're going to see the pendulum swinging back as people realize that we cannot sustain this, because this is tied to the same behaviors that in fact addict us to oil, addict us to all sorts of things. Our president believes that. So we're on an interesting knife edge now.
When you talk about the rich versus the poor and squeezing out the middle class, that's true, but when it comes to celebrity, and I want to turn back to you, Jake, it seems that we have never resented our celebrities being extraordinarily wealthy. You point out, Jake, in the books several times how you were born and bred on lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as I pointed out before, I think that there are times when we do, when the celebrities are kind of too in our face and too kind of immodest, that occasionally we kind of become resentful, but it seems to usually be short-lived. It seems to me that I would agree with Peter. I think in the long run, I would think and hope that the pendulum would swing backward. I think in the short term, however, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen anytime soon. As far as celebrity watching goes, I think with the news in a war in Iraq going from bad to worse to even worse, that celebrities provide a very convenient and attractive form of escapism. And in some ways, the best bet for maybe this tipping point that we're kind of theorizing about, I think, might have to do with this idea of the entitlement generation. You're hearing people talk about this more, about this idea of we have a whole generation that is kind of self-centered. And I think that it's important to point out that that stardom doesn't just have to be in the context of Hollywood. People can want to be stars within their various niches. My wife is a doctor. She's an endocrinologist. She often talks about the star endocrinologist. And I think that part of the tipping point may come when the marketplace is flooded with young people who expect to be the stars of their given niche without putting in any of the work, and people resenting that, and also that just not working, because society, as I think Peter was alluding to, kind of works on the sense that you have to actually put in the grunt work of learning and working your way up, and if you expect to be a star right away, the system's going to kind of fall apart. So perhaps this kind of tidal wave of the entitlement generation will kind of be the kind of sobering effect that we're talking about.
The beginning of the end. I want to get to how you end your book, Jake. You end your book at a place called The Fund. Tell us about The Fund and some of the people you met there.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot, and I talked in the book about young people who want to become famous, but I was curious about what the whole fame game would look like from the perspective of someone who is kind of at the end of their life. And so I went out to this place in California called The Fund. It's basically a retirement home that's sponsored by the Motion Picture and Television Association. And it's a retirement home for a lot of the stars of the golden era. These are people who, you know, were in films often in the 40s and even the 30s, who've kind of forgotten about, who are still kind of alive and kicking. And I talked to one guy. It's interesting. I talked to two different people out there. One was a woman named Audrey Totter, who was a big star, who kind of gave it up and kind of had almost the way your chaplain described. She got married and had kids and kind of had this real life. And the other was a fellow named Hal Riddle, who was a character actor who never hit it big. And I won't go on too long, but just it's funny because the Oscars were last night. Hal was in a wheelchair, and he said to me, "You know, I'm getting kind of older. I'm 87 years old. I can't walk. I can't read lines. But if I could get a part for a crippled octogenarian, mute, that didn't have to say anything, I still think it could happen for me. In fact, I think I'd win an Oscar.
He used the word addiction, didn't he?
He did. He talked about this pursuit for fame kind of being the driving force of his life and kind of in some ways kind of overshadowing and kind of eclipsing other life courses that he could have taken.
Well, let me, in a minute or so we have left, Jake, let me ask you an unfair question. You've written this book. You produce For All Things Considered. If this book does great, your reputation explodes, I mean, you're potentially on the path to fame.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely funny you mention that. I had this very bizarre thing that when the book came out, just by virtue of the subject matter, it commanded all this attention. And 2020 did something on an Entertainment Weekly excerpt of the book. And it was extraordinary because I had written a previous book and it didn't get a fraction of the attention. And the publisher put me up at the Waldorf and I had a hired car taking me around. Well, anyway, the book tour ends after 2 weeks and I get sent, and my wife and I live on the Navajo Reservation in rural New Mexico. And I come home and it's literally, I'm watching the tumbleweed blow across the street. And I'm kind of longingly looking at the telephone and thinking maybe one more person wants to interview me. And then the irony was not lost on me that even though my taste of it was very, very small and kind of this obscure bookish way, that there was something kind of irresistible about it. And then I kind of luckily kind of snapped out of it, and we have a three-month-old baby, and the baby cries, and, you know, life calls. But, yeah, there's
that's
no question about it.
The dopamine high you were experiencing there. And then back to the family, which probably is the healthy balance.
Right. So what I'm hearing from your story is that there's a little bit of Hal Riddle in all of us at a certain level. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. It was a great show. Really interesting.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
My guests have been Jake Halpern and Peter Weibrow, Halpern's author of Fame Junkies, The Hidden Truths Behind America's Favorite Addictions. Peter Weibrow is director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. He's executive chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science. On Tuesday, March 6, I'll be at Horsham, Pennsylvania, lecturing parents on how to listen so children will speak. Visit my webpage at www.drdangottlieb.com. Well, if you've got a question or show idea, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can find archive editions of Voices on that same webpage. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friend.
Day to day is